rest is in presenting two other bills right now, but she'll join us when she's able. First, Senator Betzold, would you be willing to move the minutes
Madam Chair.
March 30th?
Yeah, I'll move the minutes for March 30th meeting.
Senator Betzold moves the minutes from March 30th. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Opposed? Motion is adopted. Senator Erickson Ropes, we have Senate File 663 before us.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm here with the Military and Overseas Voting Provisions Act. Yes, Madam Chair.
Senator Erickson Ropes, I will move the subcommittee report. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you. Excuse me, Senator.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. We have the Military and Overseas Voting Provisions Modification Bill before you. Just a quick reminder, a couple years ago, we did carry the Minnesota Overseas Voting Act, which came to us from Pentagon officials, and they were traveling around the country to make sure that states were doing everything possible to include overseas state residents who were not available in-state during elections to be able to have their votes counted. So we changed a lot of things, and we're back with just a small additional provision, and this will affect about 200 Minnesotans. And these are people who have lived their entire lives overseas for a variety of reasons. Perhaps their parents were missionaries, perhaps their parents were career military people, and these folks don't have a state of residence, and their nearest state would be identified through their parents' last residence. So we bring a bill before you today that would give these people who are really floating out there that are citizens of the country and whose parents' last residence was Minnesota, will give them the opportunity to vote in federal elections, because right now they have no way to vote at all. And with me today is Beth Frazier from the Secretary's office, and she can answer any questions on the details of the bill.
Members, we did discuss this bill in the subcommittee, but does anyone have any questions? Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify either for or against Senate File 663? Senator Erickson Ropes moves that Senate file.
Well, she can't.
Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me. Senator Betzold
moves
that Senate File 663 be recommended to pass and referred to the floor. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Thank
Senator.
You.
Senator Clark, are you ready?
I am.
Senate File 1894.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members, this bill relates to traffic offenses and administrative fines, and there has been a compromise, and we've got a pretty large agreement. So I'm going to do, Madam Chair, if it's okay, is just talk broadly about the bill, and then Ms. Finn will go ahead and kind of walk you through it. We do have a delete everything, though. Is that correct?
Correct.
So I
Senator
believe
Clark, is this the origin of the bill?
Yes.
First committee. Senator Pappas moves the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape Senator Clark prefers. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted.
Great. Thank you so much. This bill addresses an issue that, as I think all of you are aware, has been before the legislature for the last several years. The issue is whether or not local units of government should have the authority to issue administrative citations for traffic offenses. As you'll hear, some cities and counties, and I believe you know this already, have been issuing administrative citations for traffic offenses on their own. There has been some disagreement whether this practice is or should be legal. This bill is a compromise that clarifies the issue, and representatives of the following organizations have worked together to craft this Delete Everything amendment: the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association, the Minnesota Sheriffs Association, the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, the St. Paul Police Federation, the Minneapolis Police Federation, the Department of Public Safety, the Minnesota State Patrol, the League of Cities, the Association of Minnesota Counties. The language allows cities, counties, and the State Patrol to use administrative fines for the enforcement of a limited number of violations. It requires the entities that use this authority to report the number of citations they issue and the revenues collected. Finally, it provides that a portion, $20 per citation, of the revenues collected be remitted to the state. So in these budget times, it's a win-win. Frankly, we know that there's a lot of times that people are not that some other tools that are out there may not be able to be utilized in tight financial times. So this really will help perhaps change some behavior on a personal level, not me personally, but an individual Minnesotan level. It will provide some extra funds for both our local governments and as well as for the state. And if it's okay, I would like, Madam Chair, for Ms. Finn just to walk through the Delete Everything amendment.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
Madam Chair, members, my name is Ann Finn. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. I want to thank you for hearing this bill today. We're particularly happy to be in the State and Local Government Committee because we really believe this bill is about local control and about community policing. That said, if you've served on the Transportation, Judiciary, or Public Safety Committees in recent years, you probably are all too familiar with the information I'm about to share. And so now might be a good time for you to grab a fresh cup of coffee. The issue of administrative fines for traffic enforcement is rooted in legislative actions that have increased surcharges, that is, the amount over and above the fine, on misdemeanor violations. In 2003, the legislature increased the surcharge on certain offenses, including petty misdemeanors, from $35 to $60. Then in 2005, the legislature increased the surcharge on the same category of violations from $60 to $72. Last year, it was increased again to $75. The surcharge is deposited into the state's general fund. The minimum cost of a traffic ticket for the violator is approximately $120, with just $20 staying with the jurisdiction that issues the violation. As the surcharge has increased, we have seen a trend in local units of government adopting ordinances and issuing their own traffic tickets, particularly for offenses that might be in the gray area between a warning and a state ticket. These are offenses like speeding less than 10 miles per hour above the limit and equipment violations. In 2003, then Attorney General Hatch's office issued a letter, technically not a binding opinion, stating that local units of government do not have authority to issue administrative citations for traffic offenses. The letter cites a statutory requirement that officers use the state's uniform traffic ticket, which ironically is not the same throughout the state. 2 years later, in 2005, then State Auditor Anderson issued a similar letter and began warning cities that implemented administrative fine ordinances that they were not in compliance. Under pressure, a number of cities repealed their administrative fine ordinances. Some, however, did not. To date, there has been no litigation over an administrative traffic ticket, meaning those cities that have continued the practice have done so without consequences. Meanwhile, bills have been introduced and heard in recent sessions to clarify the issue in statute. Some bills would flat out prohibit the practice. Some bills would explicitly allow it. None have passed. The League does not dispute the legal questions surrounding local authority to use administrative fines for traffic enforcement. That said, those who are using the tool, legally or not, have what we think are three good reasons for doing so. Use of administrative fines for traffic enforcement is a valuable public safety tool. City officials are acutely aware of their responsibility to provide public safety. They'll tell you that one of the most common complaints they hear from residents relates to speeding in residential areas. This is understandable. Driving 35 miles per hour in a 30-mile-per-hour zone is dangerous when children are playing and pedestrians are using right-of-way. Speaking as a mother with a garage full of bicycles, scooters, and skateboards, I can tell you that speeding in residential areas is a very real source of anxiety. We've heard from city officials that they're not comfortable asking officers to write state tickets, those that come with the $75 surcharge, for these offenses. They're also not comfortable giving warnings, which don't result in behavior changes. An administrative fine is a warning with a consequence that both changes driving behavior and demonstrates responsiveness to residents. Second, let's talk about the judicial system. It's no secret that our district courts are clogged. Appeals of statutory tickets are exacerbating this problem. In a recent legislative hearing, Judge James Swenson from the 4th District said traffic court cases are up 15% in the last 2.5 months. The judge said, quote, "People want to fight for every dollar they make," unquote. I would say this is especially true when they feel the penalty is disproportionate to the offense. Judges don't want to be handling speeding violations of 10 miles per hour or less, particularly when they're having difficulty processing orders for protection and other very serious matters. Additionally, it's very expensive for cities to defend statutory tickets when they're challenged. They incur prosecution costs, travel costs, and officer time costs. The $20 in revenue from statutory tickets doesn't cover the traffic stop, much less court costs and putting an extra officer on duty so another can sit in court. And finally, cities have traditionally used administrative penalties for enforcement of so-called quality of life ordinances, things like noise violations, property code violations, and other nuisance-related behaviors. Using administrative fines for a limited number of traffic offenses, we think, would be consistent with other authorities cities use to provide for quality of life. The compromise represented by the Delete Everything Amendment is the work of, as Senator Clark said, a group of law enforcement and local government representatives. I want to thank them and express gratitude to Senator Clark for her efforts on our behalf. The bill before you has little resemblance to legislation you may have seen related to this issue in the past. It's narrowly crafted, that is, it pertains to offenses that are low level and might otherwise result in a warning. I believe it addresses most, if not all, concerns raised by opponents in the past. Here's a brief description. The bill provides authority for the state patrol and local units of government to issue administrative citations for traffic offenses. A local unit of government may, by ordinance, authorize its police officers to issue administrative citations. The ordinance must contain a process for a violator to appeal the citation, and the process must involve a neutral third party, such as an administrative hearing officer. The violations eligible for an administrative citation are limited to these: speeding less than 10 miles per hour above the posted limit, stop line violations, and equipment violations, such as a cracked windshield. The amount of the administrative fine is $60. When a local unit of government issues the citation, two-thirds of the fine is retained by the issuing authority, and one-third must be given to the state. When the state patrol issues the citation, two-thirds of the fine is retained by the state, and one-third is turned over to the local jurisdiction where the citation was issued. Administrative citations do not go on the driver's record. And finally, local units of government that implement traffic enforcement ordinances must report the amount collected in their financial reports. With that, sorry for the length, but we appreciate it, and I would take any questions.
Madam Chair.
Senator Vickerman.
I just have to have, I want an explanation on subdivision 5. You cannot issue this citation to a commercial driver. You know, they drive me nuts when I'm going down highway. If I go 40, they go 70, and nobody picks them up. But there must be a reason. I'm just wondering.
Madam Chair and Senator Vickerman, this was a request made by the commercial drivers, the truckers. Right now we have an issue with this bill with so-called masking of a driver's record that is problematic when it comes to commercial driver's licenses. And so we've exempted these folks from the administrative fines. What it means is the officer would face the choice of giving that person either a warning or the state ticket so that it would go on their driving record for purposes of their employment.
Madam Chair.
Just curious.
Senator Chair and Senator Vickerman, I actually also been fairly annoyed by some of those driving behaviors myself, and perhaps that might be something we should look at in a different bill.
Senator Clark, this bill, if it passes this committee, is going to judiciary, but then it will go to transportation. After that. So I assume that issue will also be addressed there, Senator Vickerman.
Madam Chair, I'm not against the bill. I was just kind of curious why we're letting one group that don't get an administrative citation And poor old Vickerman, he does if he goes.
We have the commissioner here who would like to testify, and perhaps he could address that question.
Okay. Would you like him to come up now? Senator Carlson?
Madam Chair, I have a question for Ms. Finn. Madam Chair and Ms. Finn, it says in here that the city that employs the officer gets the two-thirds of the administrative fine. Does that also include cities that contract with other cities? Is it the actual employer of the officer disregarding the city that the infraction occurred?
Sir, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Madam Chair, Jim Franklin. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Sheriff's Association and also representing the Police Chiefs Association here today. The question that you ask has to do with agency contracts and contract cities that sheriffs and or some police departments may contract with. In this particular case, what we have come to an agreement on is that this is a contractual issue between the sheriff's office, as an example, and the contracting city. And so the provisions of this bill would allow for, and we have multiple situations where in some cases a contracting city may actually use a contract with a county attorney to prosecute. So we actually cross not only a service line of delivery of law enforcement, but also a service line of prosecution. In this particular case, in both of those circumstances, that would be addressed between the sheriff's office and the contract city, and then they would work out in their contracts who is going to process these fines and who and where the money will go. And it will either go directly to the community or it will be applied against the contract cost of providing the police service for the community. But we felt those are decisions that should be best left to the contracting of the county attorney, the sheriff, and the contracting city involved in that discussion.
Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair, and I can't remember your name off of it. You're saying that this is a contract issue, and so the contract might overrule that particular part of it with an arrangement between the city, the group providing the service, and the city that the infraction occurred.
Mr. Franklin.
Madam Chair and Senator, I don't know that it would overrule. It would just be one of the points that would have to be worked out with the contract city and the contractor, in this case the county in my example, and they would decide how that fine revenue would be determined. The state statute would authorize either or under this arrangement based on their contract to administer that program, and the citations would be issued in accordance with the law enforcement agency, in this case of my example, the sheriff, who would be providing the law enforcement service.
Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering what you envision when you talk about the need to provide a neutral third party to hear and rule on the challenges to the citations. Will they be set up in each of the jurisdictions, or will there be shared, hearing officers, or what's the vision for that?
Senator Clark,
I can answer.
Go ahead,
Madam Chair and Senator. We wanted to try to build as much flexibility for local units of government to meet that criteria standard, whichever way they can. Many communities already have dangerous dog ordinances or other kinds of ordinance that require a third party to be a neutral third party to hear certain kinds of things and resolve disputes, etc. Another example could be that, in my contracting example, a sheriff may contract with multiple counties or cities within a county. In that particular case, you could have one hearing officer that would do multiple cities. And so what we wanted to do was build flexibility for the contracting arrangements and or the cities to define how they wanted that definition of that third party, neutral third party, to be. And there's a number of different avenues that they could take to meet that criteria. So we tried to build something that would be flexible enough for them to make that determination at the local level.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
So this neutral third party, could it be almost anyone? I mean, could they hire one of us?
Mr. Franklin.
We would certainly recommend that it be someone that has some background in the obvious area of traffic or negotiations or perhaps mediation of some sort. Senator, being in this process here, would that qualify you? It may well do, because you see a lot of negotiations of things going on here right now. But I think we would want somebody that has some credentialing in that area, and that would be obviously respected in that area, that would be making some of these decisions. The other option is that if a person who receives an administrative citation for whatever reason simply says, I want my day in court, I want to go see a judge, they just let us know or serve notice on us that that's what they want, and we will accommodate their request.
Ms. Finn, did you want to add to that?
Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, just one other point, and that is that language was really intended to get around the practice of having city councils reviewing some of these, or having people just do it on their own. I know some cities that have implemented the ordinances right now, if the person doesn't want the administrative fine, or they want to contest it, then it would revert to a state ticket. And that is contributing to problems in the courts and those kinds of things. And we don't really think that is actually due process for the person. So if you can think of a clearer way for us to frame that, it would be fine. But we were trying to get at having at least some consistency and some due process in place. But we'd be glad to work with you if you have any ideas in that department.
Ms. Finn, it seems as though if the city is hiring a third party to hear their citations, how would that necessarily be defined as neutral? Or I suppose, though, as Mr. Franklin referenced, this is what's done under some of the dog ordinances.
Right. Madam Chair, you're correct. And this is a very common practice at the local level for other kinds of ordinance violations when people want to come in and contest it. This is something that's a very familiar tool to local units of government.
Senator Carlson.
Yeah, Madam Chair, and I'm going to address it to Senator Clark, and you can have whomever you want to answer. But it says that a ticket consists of five parts. Where do those five parts go, and is there a record established? Because it also says that a violation may not be recorded on the violator's driving record and does not constitute grounds for revocation or suspension. So what are the other parts for, and is there a record created somewhere, and is there the possibility of an enhanced infraction because you've gotten lots of tickets? This is very personal.
Madam Chair and Senator Carlson, I'd like to have Ms. Finn address that, but she and I actually went through the same. Let's face it, I think that even though we all strive to be good and careful and thoughtful drivers, we probably all have probably been within the confines of these provisions and know that changing behavior is important, and that's what we're after here. But I also appreciate your other concern, Ms. Finn.
Madam Chair and Senator Carlson, that section of the bill that you're referencing right now is actually something that's a bit of a work in progress. We have not necessarily worked out whether this will be a checkoff box on the uniform ticket or whether there will be, in fact, a uniform administrative ticket. And that's something that we are in consultation with the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association over, and as well as the Department of Public Safety. And our position, at least, would be that this is a separate ticket altogether. The second part of your question as to whether it's tracked, at the present time, I don't believe that there's a way to do that under the state information system. However, we're on the cusp of moving to a new system, and I think that conversation likely will happen in the Transportation Committee. But I think that in a few years, the state will have the capability of being able to put these offenses into some kind of system. For purposes of this bill, we don't want the reporting to be on the driver's record, but we don't have any, I don't think, concerns about keeping track of who's had an administrative violation, so that if they're a repeat offender, the officer has the discretion then to issue a state ticket to maybe make the driver take a little more caution.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
But isn't it true, as soon as you record it, it becomes public data, and then it's anybody can get at it, insurance companies, prospective employers, all of those people, when they have access to it, if it's recorded somewhere by a public entity?
Mr. Franklin.
Madam Chair, Representative, or Senator Roebling, you are correct. This would become, if this were a administrative violation, it would become, after the processing of that, a public record under Data Practices Act. This is a public document. Somebody could go around to all of the police agencies in the state of Minnesota and try to collect that data. Right now, there is not a central repository where that data would go into for a centralized collection system. This differs from a state citation that goes through the court. The court becomes the collection point. That's fed into the driver's license section, and we have that current system. We do not have a current system to track verbal warnings, written warnings, or administrative fines. There just is no system in the state of Minnesota in place to do that. Could there be someday down the road? Yes, I believe the commissioner's long-term plans are to have such a system that would be able to. Would we as law enforcement officers think that's a good idea? Yes, we probably would, because we'd be able to look at it and see that perhaps you've had five administrative warning violations and maybe it's time for a state citation. Currently, we're just not able to deal with that because the technology is not there. But you are absolutely correct with regards to your question. Does this become open data or public data after the processing of that? You are correct.
Senator Clark, or to one of the testifiers, if the state patrol would write a ticket for, someone who's speeding but going less than 10 miles under the, or 10 mile, less than 10 miles over the posted limit, where would that ticket, if the state patrol chose to write an administrative ticket, where would they hear that? If the driver wanted to appeal it, where would that go under this language?
Madam Chair, again, we allowed that for the state patrol in that particular circumstance if they so chose to do one of two things. They could have a hearing officer, neutral third party for the whole state. They could have it by geographic area, or if they chose, they could contract with a county, city, to have and use their hearing officer for that violation. So there's several different options there of how they could do that. And again, we're trying to build latitude into what makes sense given the geographic area and or the state, how they determine that they want to do that.
So right now, if a trooper writes a ticket under this provision, then and a person wants to appeal it, they can hear it. They would have their citation heard within their county. And under this language, it could take place anywhere in the state. Or there may be just one location?
Madam Chair, maybe just my idea, and then the commissioner can certainly jump in. But my thought would be we would recommend trying to keep it as local as possible. So if a trooper wrote a citation in Kennebec County and Kennebec County was participating in the program, or Pine County, wherever they were, that the state would be able to go use that county system, and there would be a contract in place or something that would between the state DPS and the county that would be heard at the most local level. That would be our recommendation.
I assume that could be discussed in Judiciary Committee too. Is there anyone?
Can we have
Senator Clark?
The commissioner would like to have him testify just briefly,
sure.
If that's okay.
Commissioner Campion.
Madam Chair,
to the
Michael Campion, Commissioner of Public Safety. Two very quick points. One, an answer to Senator Brickman's question on the masking or the commercial driver's license provision in the statute. If administrative fines were issued to commercial drivers, the state of Minnesota would probably be in jeopardy of receiving federal highway transportation money. A requirement from NHTSA is that you can't allow that. Masking is what it's called to take place with people with commercial driver's license. That's why they're exempt in this bill. That add some clarity, I think, to your question, I hope. And lastly, Madam Chair, this issue's been around since I've been commissioner over 5 years. The legislature has to weigh in on this. A lot of people have worked on this. DPS supports it. We think this is a very good compromise, and we support the legislation.
Thank you. Is there anyone in the audience who'd like to testify either for or against Senate File 1894? Senator Olstein?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've opposed this in the past for some of the things that we've discussed here because you could offend in Pine County, Kanabec County, Chisago, Isanti, and each county would have your record, but nobody would be exchanging that information. So if someone was getting a ticket instead, then by that time they'd probably have their license revoked. So I'm glad to hear that this is moving towards, you know, possibly having that information available to different departments. And also I'm glad you addressed the masking. That was a concern. And this might work out pretty well. I believe Senator Foley has a bill that's looking at having magistrates and those kinds of things that might be able to handle a fine like that. But having all said all that, I'm still not sure if I'm quite there yet on the bill because I am concerned about just what I said, that you can offend in different areas and just keep offending and nobody has a record of it and your license isn't suspended. So.
Madam Chair, Department of Public Safety Bureau of Criminal Apprehension is in the process of rolling out a cybers data system, a comprehensive incident-based reporting system. We think that system, as it rolls out in the next several months to a year, will be able to accommodate that, and law enforcement will be able to query that system to find out, for instance, if Michael Campion got a speeding administrative citation earlier that morning or in the recent past in order to make a more prudent decision. So I think that availability of that information for law enforcement will be not too far in the distant future.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Clark.
Senator Olstein, that's been one of the concerns that I've had. And I think that if law enforcement does have that as a tool, my preference would be, since this is not supposed to be for insurance purposes, that we figure out some way to deal with that. But truly, we don't want to have people. I mean, right now, you have to rely on somebody when they ask you, do you have a good record? Well, will somebody be truthful? I would hope they would be. But right now, an officer would not have that knowledge, and this bill does put us on that path.
Senator Roebling?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering if someone could just explain what all the sections are on 2.27 and 2.28. It appears that it's vehicle violations. As someone mentioned, a cracked windshield. I'm just wondering what else those might be, and if the current practice of handling those is not, isn't it usually that they issue a warning and then you have so many days to repair it? But would they instead now be likely to issue a administrative ticket or fine, and you lose your time period to go and fix it?
Mr. Franklin,
Madam Chair, and Senator Roebling, as it relates to the warning violations or equipment violations that you're talking about right now, there are a lot of agencies, perhaps in the metro area, that don't even deal with that anymore simply because of the paperwork involved. In Greater Minnesota, there's quite a few agencies that still use the written warning where you get a headlight out, windshield cracked, you get it fixed, you send back your receipt or something, or somebody signs off that it's checked. Again, this whole bill is all voluntary. Cities may choose not to do this. If they choose not to, that's fine. The current practice of whatever you're using of written violations or verbal violations or state citations is at your disposal. This is just one more tool in the box that you have an option to use. We would recommend that if you have a current written warning program, that you continue on with it. If it's working for you, as it is in many places in Greater Minnesota, continue on. Nothing's broke. If you wanted to switch to this and give out a administrative fine violation, you could do that. Again, I guess we would say maybe that's an option instead of a state citation. You could send them a administrative violation. Not sure that I would recommend that, but that could be an option. But we really think that if something's working for you now, there's no need to change. This does give the option for someone that says, you know, I really want to get tough on a particular violation. Maybe it's cracked windshields or something. You could use the administrative route here to go after that if you so chose. But we've tried to build options for people here. And just add one more tool to the box as opposed to what we currently have.
Senator Robley, Mr. McGowan's ready to specify what those sections are if you'd like that.
Well, Madam Chair, it's a fairly long list. I can go through it if you'd like. 169.47 is unsafe equipment. 471 is watching TV while you're driving. 475 is use of a wireless communication device. 48 is vehicle lighting. 49 is headlamps, improper headlamps. 169.50 is improper rear lamps. 169.52 is projecting a load. You have to have a flag when you have a load. 522 is a slow-moving vehicle. The decal, it says you're moving slowly. Let's see. The other three are lighting violations, vehicle signals. You have to have proper signals under 57. Identification lamps. Certain lights permitted on older motor vehicles. Certain prohibited lamps. Let's see, where do you go? 68.
Big book with you.
No, that sort of thing. And then 169.69 to 0.75 is muffler, noise, windshield, tires, studs, bumpers, fenders, that sort of thing. So it's various forms of equipment violations.
Senator Clark, one thing that I just gleaned from the testifier, so this would just be an option for local units of government, but local units of government that are still administering their own citations could continue to do that, or would that be prohibited and they would have to do this instead?
Madam Chair, local units of government that are currently administering a administrative fine program would have to change and come into compliance with this one. Some have a $65 administrative fee. Some have $50. We struck the balance at a common $60 with the division that you all see in front of you as a compromise. But we would have all current programs come in compliance with this. We have a uniform approach through the whole state.
If they want to do it. Senator Olstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With Commissioner Campion's testimony about they might have a system ready to, in 6 months, I don't see an enactment date. Am I missing that? Or
this means August 1st.
It would mean August 1st then.
Okay.
Senator Olstein.
Thank you.
Senator Robley.
Thank you. So if people are issued the citations, would they be just told to send the money in to the appropriate location, or how will the fine be submitted?
Madam Chair and Senator, the final provision of the bill talks a little bit about the process of the citation that we're going to be used and how we're going to get that notification to the driver. The intent is that when the driver is issued this administrative fine, they will also be given either an envelope or a slip of paper or something that says you are in Pine County and you will, you know, send your violation to this address, and then it will also have something about you can appeal that this way, call this phone number or something of that nature. That is going to have to be somewhat unique to the obvious geographic area of which the citation is issued, and so each jurisdiction who is participating in this will have to have that paperwork with their administrative citations. What we wanted to do was ensure that uniformity in the format of that was done on a statewide basis the same. So that is part of the work that we will be working with the commissioner and the various associations to come up with that framework and those forms, if you will, to make sure everybody's doing it the same.
Madam Chair. Senator Robley, you know, I think the other thing to be thinking about is taxi cabs are largely now switched over to being able to take credit cards, and at some point my guess is you can pay on the spot. I mean, where technology is rapidly changing, and we maybe get to the point that you can take care of that all in one fell swoop. And I think for members, that one of the things that I think this agreement has brought forward is some ways to start simplifying some of what needs to be done on a local level. We have some huge issues, as you know, with the judicial budgets, can take off some of the burden there. We can help to some extent with some of the local budgetary issues, trying to figure out how we're making sure that we're keeping some funding locally and helping our state budget as well. So hopefully, we've got a couple more committees that we'll be going to too, and I think we've got a couple more pieces to be working out, but that's where we're at.
Senator Carlson.
Madam Chair, and I think Commissioner, there's it says in here that the that a warrant, arrest warrant, may be issued for failure to appear, and I'm assuming that that's also for failure to pay. Who actually takes the responsibility to follow up if there isn't payment made? That's on 1.27. Can a warrant be issued for non-payment of this level of tag?
Madam Chair, Senator Carlson, yes. If worse comes to worse and there's no communication and there's a profound refusal to administer to or adhere to the legislation, or the law, yes.
And Madam Chair, Senator Carlson, that happens with parking tickets as well. In some places.
Madam Chair. Senator Rest.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move the bill, please. Senate file 1894, as amended, be recommended to pass and refer to the Judiciary Committee.
Is there anyone in the audience who would like to speak either in favor or against the bill? Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I apologize as I was late for another from another committee, but just one quick question about on page 2 under the administrative citations for traffic offenses. It says a peace officer who issues a citation for infraction of speeding under 10 miles over the limit must use the actual speed and may not reduce it for purposes of qualifying. How does one enforce it? I remember under the Dimmler Amendment, enforcement officers were taking a going 40 in a 35 zone or 45 in a 35 zone and pleading it down to a 60 in a 55 zone. We put it in the law, and is there any way to enforce that?
Mr. Franklin.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, I'll try to take a crack at that. It's difficult to enforce. This, I think, language in the statute tries to provide guidance, and attempts to provide guidance to the chief of police and the law enforcement, the sheriff of that particular jurisdiction. The intent is not to, obviously not to abuse the administrative fine option.
Senator Robin.
I just want to ask about the non-supplant language in here. It indicates that you can't cut the budget of the law enforcement and then supplant it with this money. But what if the budget was going to be cut anyway? I mean, every community is facing the possibility of budget cuts across the board. So, are we going to have somebody challenge that and say, well, you're cutting the budget, and now you're hoping to backfill it with some of this? So I just want to make sure that they don't get into a bind here.
Madam Chair and Senator, that goes kind of hand in hand with Senator Marty's question: is how do we regulate that? Again, we understand difficult times; all budgets are being cut. What we didn't want to do was give an inducement for a city council or somebody to cut a budget and then send their police out to write a lot of administrative fine violations. We just don't want that type of a situation occurring because we think that's inappropriate. But certainly in times like this where everybody's budget is getting cut, I think we all understand those kinds of circumstances. And other than flagrant violations of some sort, I don't think that that's going to be an issue.
Senator Rest moves that Senate file 1894, as amended, be referred to the Judiciary Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
Motion passes. Thank you, Senator Clark.
Next bill on the agenda is Senate file 970, Senator Sebring, early voting authorization.
You're tough.
We're going to get a lot more tickets. They'll be going 2 miles over 11. And you said they'd be at 9 girl. But you'll go 2 miles over the limit and you'll get one of those.
Senator Sebin moves adoption of the subcommittee report on Senate file 970. We won't take that up. We'll just take your delete all amendment.
Senator Rest, or Madam Chair and committee members, the A2 amendment incorporates the committee report. And it also
What other changes are made in the delete all?
It incorporates the committee report, and it also changes the effective date of the when early voting would be implemented. So that, as you'll see on page...
Senator Stephen, could you move the microphone just a little bit closer?
Sure.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Bonner.
Mr. Bonner.
Perhaps can explain it.
There is a separate A3 amendment that has some of those technical changes you're talking about. The A2 amendment simply reflects, it's basically an engrossment.
It's an engrossment, okay. I think members understand that then. So Senator Stephen moves the A2 delete all amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. And now we have a technical amendment, Mr. Bonner.
Madam Chair, that's the A3 amendment, and it's largely technical, except for in on lines 1.30 to 1.35, it would say so that the effective date of when early voting would take place is after the Secretary of State has certified that counties or cities are able to implement early voting, and it would not happen at the earliest until the state primary election in 2010. And that was to address some of the concerns that were expressed in the subcommittee.
Okay, do people understand how the A3 amendment brings the bill into order? Senator Stephen moves adoption of the A3 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. So now we have the bill in order. Before us, Senator Stephen, would you like to go through the major provisions of the bill? And I assume that Ms. Fraser is here to answer any questions.
Right. Madam Chair, would you like me to go through the entire bill? We did hear it in the subcommittee. But
If you would go through the bill for the benefit of those who are not on the subcommittee, but I don't intend to take any additional testimony, only to have people answer questions. So, Senator Stephen, if you would do that, please.
Madam Chair, I think I'll ask Ms. Fraser to go through the section by section.
Okay, Ms. Fraser, if you identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Beth Fraser from the Office of the Secretary of State. Section 1 is primarily a technical section in that it requires that the statewide voter registration system provide the necessary reports. Section 3 provides a definition of early voting, that it's in-person voting prior to Election Day. Section 4 updates the violation section, saying that violations are of absentee balloting laws or early voting laws. Section 5 says that in order for a municipal clerk to administer absentee balloting or early voting, they have to have the technological capacity to use the statewide voter registration system and that they would have to be trained. Section 6 is... Section 6 relates to outreach that's currently required to healthcare facilities and saying that instead of administering absentee voting at the healthcare facility, they would be administering early voting at the healthcare facility. Oh, I'm sorry, that was Section 4. I misspoke. Section 5 says that you do not need an excuse to vote early and exempts town and school district standalone elections until 2014. Section 6 says that early voting is during the 30 days prior to Election Day up through the fourth day before the election. Section 7 talks about the hours that it has to be available, including at least one evening and at least one Saturday. Section 8 talks about where early voting occurs and has language very similar to that for designating locations for in-person absentee voting. Section 9 requires that the county notify voters on their website as to when early voting is available. Section 10 lays out the procedures for early voting, saying that voters will enter, sign a roster swearing that they are eligible, and that the ballots must be initialed and handed to the voter and put in a ballot box. The county auditor or municipal clerk must record in the statewide voter registration system that the person has voted. This is a key security measure so that they can't vote more than once. It would be in the system. So if they tried to vote early again or vote on election day, there would be a note this person has already voted. It says that the rosters have to be marked so that if people show up in the polling place, it will be clear that they have already voted. It says that it outlines procedures for at the end of the day, the staff have to remove the ballots and seal and secure them, ensuring that the number of ballots is equal to the number of voters, and that after the polls have closed, that's when they tabulate the votes, that the votes are not tabulated prior to that. For state elections, the votes have to be allocated back to the appropriate precinct, so you could still look at the statistics and know that you got as a candidate your votes from Frogtown as opposed to Summit Hill or something, even if the people voted early. Section 11 relates to the roster and says that for early voting, the roster has to clearly state that I understand that after I've cast my ballot today, I cannot vote again in this election. Section 12 talks about the testing of the voting equipment and saying that testing of equipment for early voting has to be done as soon as practicable after it's available. Section 13 deals with the post-election review and says that the early ballots are considered a precinct for the purposes of possibly being chosen to be reviewed. Section 16 repeals a section of law related to, I don't have this in front of me. And then the effective date, again, as Senator Sieben explained, it's not effective until we have certified that the statewide voter registration system can function in the way that's required to administer early voting, and that voting equipment is available that can tabulate multiple precincts. Right now, some of the equipment is limited to about 10 precincts, and in counties like Hennepin, where there are over 500 precincts, that would require too many machines. So we're requiring that this wouldn't go into effect until we can have equipment that makes it more manageable. I'd be happy to answer any
questions. Are there questions or comments for Senator Sieben? Senator Sieben, on page 6, line 1, and this is part of the section on voting procedures, it seems to me that you would want to specify that we're talking about the polls closing on election day and not just on any day that people have come in and cast an early ballot. Mr. Bodden, would you suggest there to make sure it's for on any election day, both the primary and the general? What would we need there?
Madam Chair, for now, I think if you insert after closed on election day, that will suffice. I'll see if I can think of something that's a little broader.
Okay. Senator Vickerman moves to insert before the comma on election day. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Comments, amendments, whatever. Senator Marty and then Senator Roebling.
Madam Chair, Senate Counsel, I assume you can just change the section numbers just to correct them because we got two section fives and sixes and we're missing a 15 and so on.
We will instruct
them.
Senate Counsel to renumber the sections. Here we have section 5 and section 6, and then we went back to section 5 and section 6. So there's two 5s and two 6. That will be correct.
15.
And no 15 and 15. 14.
Sometimes those things happen.
I've never seen it before.
And no 15.
Or
we'll
14.
Take, or 14. It will be taken care of. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Sieben, I know this is a few years out, but the early voting requirement for the towns or school districts, and looking at what they must do, that they have to have it available 30 days ahead of time, that they have to have regular hours when they would be able to vote from 8 to 4:30 plus an extended day and one half Saturday. I'm thinking of these little townships that have really no staff, no one manning the town hall, and I'm trying to figure out what we're expecting from them for this early voting. I don't understand why an absentee ballot in many of those cases isn't just, I mean, why can't we just expect them to use that system instead?
Senator Sieben?
Madam Chair, I'm just asking Ms. Frazier, I think that currently if you live in a township and you want to vote absentee in person, so for instance you want to cast an absentee ballot before election day in person, then those township residents would go to their county office or a nearby city, but perhaps I should turn it over to Ms.
Frazier. Ms. Frazier, what happens for those township residents?
But Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, the townships are already required to administer in-person absentee voting. So they're already required to be open and available during the 30 days preceding the election for voters to come in and vote. If you look on page on the amendment, the A3 amendment, there is a section here on lines 112 to 123, which talks about additional hours that they must be open, but they already have to be open and available. So this doesn't impose much of a burden.
Senator Roebling.
Madam Chair, I think a lot of people break the law then. I haven't never heard of my township having hours. I think maybe you could go to the courthouse and vote. And I think that's probably been the practice in most counties with townships. But it sounds like they're going to have to do that right away for the primary and statewide elections. But now they will also have to do it in 2014 for the township and school district elections, which are, you know, the township elections are often in March. And then we have, so they are going to be doing it more times unless they bring their election cycle into the general election date, which many of them have resisted. They have the opportunity to do that, but they haven't wanted to do it. So, I mean, we're going to be hitting them a couple of times.
Madam Chair.
Senator Sieben.
And Senator Roebling, the amendment, we did exclude the townships and school districts from having to administer early voting in their own township or school district elections up until 2014, mm-hmm. and said that, you know, at that point or before then, we can revisit it to address the issue. But Mr. Solem is here from the townships.
Briefly, Mr. Solem, we've already had testimony on this.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Ken Solem with the Minnesota Association of Townships. Senator Roebling, you are correct that in the vast majority of situations with the absentee voting, the in-person is being done at the county courthouse. There are currently a handful of townships that are doing it themselves, but it's definitely the rare exception and not the rule. And actually, with other changes being made with the use of the statewide voter registration system, my reading of the statutes is those townships won't be able to administer their own program anyhow because they don't have access, wouldn't have the technology to use the equipment that's going to be required under other provisions of law. So I think that anything to make this work would have to solely be done at the county courthouse. That's why the 2014 date was put in place. That gives us some time to figure out what's going to be real. But, and I know Tom Deans from the school district, school board association share the same concerns. The only practical way to make this work at school and town elections is to do it solely at the county.
Are there other questions or comments for Senator Sieben at this time? Seeing none, Senator Sieben moves that Senate file 970 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Finance. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Senator Sieben, Senate File 991.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 991 is the election administration bill that the Secretary of State's office asked me to carry. So, and we did not hear this in the subcommittee. So because this is the first committee hearing, I'm wondering if we could first move the A3 amendment to get the bill in the shape I'd like it. And then I'll ask Ms. Frazier to...
We need to have the amendment distributed. Thank you.
Once the committee members have that, then we could move that amendment, and I'd ask Ms. Frazier to describe the amendment and the bill. Is there
summary? It will have to take some time on this because there's no summary for members to follow. Senator Sieben moves adoption of the A3 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Okay, Ms. Frazier, section by section, slowly.
Okay. Madam Chair, Ms. Frazier does have a summary that she shared with me, so if we want to set this bill aside, we could have copies made of her summary.
Senate file 991 is laid on the table temporarily. Senator Sieben brings us Senate file 1331. Senator Sieben.
Madam Chair, Senate file 1331 is the deals with absentee ballots and changes that were brought forth to me from the Secretary of State's office. So I'd ask Ms. Frazier to explain.
Is there an amendment to this bill, Senator Sieben?
Yes, there is.
Okay, why don't we put that on there right away as well?
A1 amendment. And again, this is the first committee that this has been heard in.
Senator Sieben moves adoption of the A1 amendment to Senate file 1331. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Looks like we have the same thing here. It's either one or the other. But Ms. Frazier, slowly through the bill.
Aye. Madam Chair and members, this bill basically does four things. And it takes many changes to do each of the four. But generally, what it does is it changes the way that we process absentee ballots so that we no longer process them in the precincts and instead have absentee ballot boards at the city or county level accept and reject them more centrally. One of the, I think, clearest things that came out of the Senate recount is that there are issues with absentee ballots, and this bill is designed to address some of those issues. The second general thing that this bill is intended to do is to establish a standard process for reviewing rejected absentee ballots to ensure that any that were improperly rejected are identified and opened and counted prior to the results being canvassed. The third thing that the bill does is it removes some hurdles to getting absentee ballots accepted, including allowing pre-registered voters to self-certify that they received the ballot and it was blank and that they personally filled it out, and replacing signature matches with ID number matches, which is what we do with the UACAVA, the overseas and military ballots, and that worked very successfully. Our local election administrators are trained in many things, but handwriting analysis is not one of them. And so being able to match ID numbers would be much simpler. Right. And so a Minnesota driver's license or state ID card or the last four digits of a Social Security number. The final thing that this bill does is it sends voters with ongoing absentee ballot status. So voters who on an ongoing basis expect to be out of the precinct or unavailable to go to the polling place. Right now, they are sent an application prior to every election, and this changes that so that they would be sent actually the ballot itself. So
if you'd go through the bill now, then.
So Section 1 does the following. It requires applicants for absentee ballots to provide their driver's license, state ID card number, or the last four digits of their Social Security number, if they have any of these numbers. It requires applicants to sign an oath that the information on the form is accurate and they are personally applying for the ballot. And it provides a conforming change for Section 2. Section 2 sends voters with ongoing absentee ballot status a ballot for each election, not an application. And it does this by sending ongoing absentee voters a postcard 60 days prior to the state primary to clean up the list, to identify anyone who may have died or who otherwise shouldn't be sent a ballot. By allowing ongoing absentee voters to opt out of receiving ballots for certain elections. So if we're going to send them the ballots directly, we want to know that they're actually interested in receiving them. So if a person only votes in state general elections, they could say, don't send me anything else, just the state general election ballot.
Ms. Fraser, where is the provision that it's an ongoing absentee ballot? Where does it say that? Oh, I see. That's in current law.
226. It's current law in
okay.
Line 2.20, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. I see it now.
The third thing that this does is at the beginning of the changes to ongoing absentee ballot status, the counties would send applications to all voters with this status to give the voter the opportunity to opt out of receiving some of the ballots and to have an application that can be scanned in and maintained on file. Section 3 limits municipal clerks from processing absentee ballots to those with the technological capacity.
Ms. Fraser, so the effective date there is what comes in on the amendment. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair.
It's a change. It's an effective date for Section 2.
Yes.
Okay.
Section 3 limits municipal clerks so that only those with the technological capacity to use the statewide voter registration system can be designated to process absentee ballots. Section 4 provides a conforming cross-reference. Section 5.
And you deleted the old 17 through 24, and that's part of the amendment as well, correct? What was the difference between that and what you currently and that was in the bill?
One of the changes in the amendment is that the effective date used to be grouped at the end and said these sections are effective at this time and these sections are effective at this time. And so one of the things the amendment does is it puts after each section when it is effective to make that clearer.
But lines 1-7 to 1-15, are they the same?
Oh,
as 17 to 24?
They're primarily the same. The amendment makes a technical change so that whether a clerk is designated or whether they voluntarily opt to administer absentee balloting, they can only do that in either case if they have the technological capacity. Okay. The way the bill was originally written, it only applied if they were designated.
Okay.
Section 5 requires the use of the statewide voter registration absentee ballot application for state elections. Clerks or auditors would need to note that an application has been received and a ballot sent, that a ballot has been received, a ballot's acceptance or rejection, and if a replacement ballot has been sent. Section 6.
And the new Section 6, starting on the amendment at line 26?
The new Section 6 relates to mailing absentee ballots. And because we are now requiring all voters to provide a state ID or driver's license number, we're requiring that there be an extra envelope to protect that information, which is already the case for voters who are registering with their absentee ballot and for overseas and military voters. Section 6 in the bill does three things. It requires that voters provide ID numbers, state ID, driver's license, or the last four digits of their Social Security number on the absentee ballot envelope if they have them. It allows voters to self-certify that the ballots arrived blank and that they filled them out personally. That's for pre-registered voters. And for voters who are not pre-registered, they would be allowed to have any U.S. citizen serve as a witness for their proof of residence instead of just limiting it to registered Minnesota voters.
Madam Chair?
Senator Pappas.
I just wanted to know if the intention is either the driver's license, the state ID, or the last four digits. That's clear on page 5, lines 5-3 to 5-4. But I'm wondering, going back to 2-3 to 2-5, 2-4, it looks like it's and on 2.4. The applicant Minnesota driver's license or state ID card number and the last four digits. Is that the way you wanted it? You wanted and there?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Senator Pappas, the rationale for doing that is on the application, if we have the voter provide us with all of those numbers, then no matter which of them they put on their ballot certification, we can match it.
Okay. All right.
And on page 5, it's just the matching that's being done.
Okay.
Continue, Ms. Fraser.
Yes. The final thing that's done in Section 6 in the bill is it allows any U.S. citizen to serve as a witness. Section 7 specifies that absentee ballots must be returned if they're mailed, that they should be mailed to the local official who is responsible for accepting and rejecting the ballots. Section 8 requires that ballot boards be given absentee ballots within 5 days of receipt, except during the 14 days before the election, in which case they must be turned over within 3 days. Section 9 does several things. Subdivision 1 requires all entities administering absentee ballots establishing a ballot board, and that either partisan election judges with party balance or their staff, in which case they don't need to worry about party balance, which is how the military and overseas ballot boards worked and worked very well this past year. The amendment clarified that this could be either county staff or municipal staff, depending on who is serving as the ballot board and administering the ballots. Subdivision 2 requires that ballots be accepted and rejected as they are received by the ballot board, and changes the requirements for accepting a ballot so that it is accepted if the certification is signed by the voter and if the ID numbers match, if ID numbers were provided. If the ID numbers either don't match or ID numbers were not provided, because there are some Minnesotans without any of those ID numbers, then officials would rely on other information provided, which means primarily a signature match, which is how, again, it works for the military and overseas voters and was very successful. Subdivision 3 requires that accepted ballots be noted on the roster or a supplemental report for state and for state elections in the statewide voter registration system. Subdivision 3A requires that voters whose ballots are rejected more than 5 days before the election be sent replacement ballots, and that there be an attempt made to contact those whose ballots are rejected within 5 days of the election by either phone or email, and any attempt to contact a voter about a rejected absentee ballot must be documented.
And Ms. Fraser, how are we going to hold those people accountable for doing that?
Madam Chair,
what's the penalty if they don't?
Well, any...
if the election official does not send the ballot back or does not make an effort to contact the person whose absentee ballot is spoiled?
Madam Chair, a violation of most election law is a felony.
So would that be the case if an election official was found that an election official, for whatever reason, did not send these back? Would that happen there and be a felony?
I need to double check on that. I'm not sure.
I think that was one of the things we had asked when people were talking and just generally discussing absentee ballots before, that what they did was, you know, put them in a pile and then they would start calling. But, you know, what if somebody noticed that was an absentee ballot and they were sure the party was going to be voting for someone that the official didn't like? Does that does that ballot go to the bottom of the pile, and maybe they get called and maybe they don't? So I mean, there's got to be some accountability in there. And I'm not saying that anybody does that, but if the law doesn't provide for accountability, then there certainly would be that temptation.
Madam Chair, I was just told it's a gross misdemeanor to not carry out a mandatory statutory requirement.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Bodden.
I think it's actually a misdemeanor that's somewhere. I can get the exact site for you, but there is a provision that's generally applicable. I'm not sure whether it applies to state agencies and acts they're required to perform. That's, I can double check that.
Might want to find that out. This bill is ready to go to the floor, as I understand it, Senator Stevens, so I'd be interested in knowing that. I have
Madam,
at 991.
This is
13. I'm sorry, 1331 goes to finance. I'm sorry. Looking at 991. Okay, so there's another stop to check that out. If you would make a note of that, please. Ms. Fraser?
Madam Chair, Subdivision 4 requires that accepted ballots be immediately opened, duplicated if necessary, and placed in the ballot box. Subdivision 4A requires that ballots in the ballot box be removed and secured each evening, balanced with the number of ballots accepted that day, that rosters marked or supplemental reports be generated, and that it be verified that voters did not vote in person before ballots accepted after rosters were marked or supplemental reports were generated are opened and counted. On election night, the votes must be totaled, and the vote totals may not be made available before the polls have closed.
And Ms. Fraser, for 4A, what problem does that solve with regard to absentee ballots? What situation would this, you know, take care of that might be happening under current law?
Madam Chair, one of the primary goals of this bill is to stop the processing of absentee ballots in the polling place. That basically right now absentee ballots are processed by 30,000 volunteers, election judges, who do the job once or twice every couple of years. And we believe that if they're done more centrally at the city or county level, they can be done more uniformly and by more, with people with more training and expertise in this area. In order to accomplish the work that 30,000 people currently do by a much smaller number of people, we need to spread the work out and have it done as the ballots come in. And so this, so Subdivision 4A just establishes procedures because we don't currently open and count absentee ballots as they come in. It establishes procedures similar to the early voting procedures for dealing with the ballots.
Okay.
It would allow absentee ballots that come in after the rosters have been marked or supplemental reports have been generated. It would allow, it would require that before those could be opened and counted, that the election official check to be sure the person did not vote in person in the polling place. And if that is allowed to happen either on election day or on election night or within 48 hours after the election, it must be done within that time period.
Why is the language in sub 6 deleted?
Criminal provision.
Is that just the current process?
Madam Chair, this is deleted because all of the municipalities or school districts would be required to have a ballot board.
Mr. Bodden, you have the answer about the penalties?
Madam Chair, I reviewed the, just to be clear, about the felony provisions for absentee voting. That's in 203B03. None of them would appear to apply here. And Ms. Fraser is correct. Section 609.43 of the statutes basically provides gross misdemeanor penalties for public officers who intentionally fail or refuse to perform known mandatory duties and so forth. So that's what would apply here.
Thank you. Ms. Fraser?
Yes, Madam Chair. Subdivision 7 makes the names of voters whose absentee ballots have been accepted public data. Right now, if you've applied for an absentee ballot, that's private data, and that's in part because you won't have completed voting until after Election Day, whereas this, once, because we would be opening and counting ballots as they arrive, you would be done voting, and this would allow candidates to and parties to know who was done voting, and would allow you to stop bothering voters.
And so, Ms. Fraser, this this change in absentee balloting, you don't have the opportunity to come on Election Day and overturn the absentee ballot. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, that is correct, and that's the way it is in many, many other states.
I like that.
Section 10 requires that military and overseas ballots be opened, duplicated as necessary, and placed in the ballot box as they are received, but makes an exception for federal write-in absentee ballots because in many cases military and overseas voters fill out the federal write-in absentee ballot and send it in if they're not sure their ballot will arrive on time. So we hold these ballots to see if a regular ballot comes in which case that would be counted and this would be discarded. Section 11 makes conforming changes related to acceptance and rejection of the military and overseas ballots, including that an absentee ballot would only accept ballots if the voter is not known to have died. Section 12 replaces a requirement that a record of military and overseas voters be sent to the precinct with a requirement that a record be generated and retained with other election materials. Sections 13 and 14 make changes to mail ballot precincts and mail ballot elections, requiring that ballots be similarly processed, opened, and counted. Section 15 requires that the polling place roster state first, that the voter has not already voted in the election, and that this, as well as the understanding that providing false information is a felony, that be put in bold type. It also requires that when signing voters in, if the rosters have not been marked, that the supplemental report be reviewed before voters are allowed to vote to ensure that they have not already voted. Section 16 deletes obsolete language related to challenging absentee ballots in the polling place since they'll no longer be sent to the polling place. Section 17 to 21 and Section 23 establish a process for the regular review of rejected absentee ballots after each state general election to identify any that were improperly rejected. It requires the county auditor to review all the rejected absentee ballots prior to the county canvass, that the county canvassing board, if they agree with the auditor's determination, open and count the votes from the improperly rejected absentee ballots. And it switches the order of the canvassing board meetings to allow the votes in local races on those ballots, in school board or city or township races, to be included in their original canvassed results. Section 22 provides a conforming cross-reference to the section related to ballot boards. Section 23 relates to the changing the canvassing board meetings. Section 24 allows absentee ballots to be considered a precinct that could be selected for the purposes of the post-election review. And Section 25 is the repealer section, and it repeals the 203B04 sub 5, which outlines permanent absentee ballot status because this is being combined with ongoing absentee ballot status. It's repealing 203B.10, requiring the delivery of absentee ballot applications to election judges in the precinct, deleting 203B.13, establishing absentee ballot boards. All of the relevant provisions have been moved to 203B.12, and 203B.25, procedures for processing absentee ballots in the precinct on election day.
Ms. Fraser, we got through, I think, the first page of the amendment through and down through just putting in those effective date sections. You want to explain what 222?
Yes.
Line 222, and that's new subdivision does?
The new subdivision on starting on line 222 is similar to, but significantly different than, the provision that was in temporarily Senator Pappas's bill and was deleted in subcommittee, related to allowing voters to go onto our website to see whether they're the status of their absentee ballot. The primary difference here is that in order for a voter to check on the status, they would have to provide additional information to ensure that it's just the voter and that it's not easy for people to look up other people's status, since this is private data. So it would require a person to provide their name, their address, their date of birth, and their driver's license number, state identification number, or the last four digits of their Social Security number.
What about Section 10?
Section 10 changes, says that local election officials do not have to administer both in-person absentee voting and early voting simultaneously, that during the between the 30th day and the fourth day before the election, they're only administering early voting, and that on the day before the election, there would be in-person absentee voting, but that would be limited to those who additionally certify that they just found out that they cannot go to the polling place. That's the same for Section 11. The 3.26 of the amendment, changing administer to accept and reject, more carefully targets which jurisdictions have to create absentee ballot boards. The change on line 3.27, deleting the words and certified, allows counties and cities to use staff to administer absentee ballots if they've been trained as election judges, but whom on border towns, they may actually not be Minnesota residents, and so they could not be certified as election judges because they're not eligible to vote in Minnesota, so we're deleting those words. 3.28 replaces election judges with members of the ballot board to make it more clear who's doing those duties. The words on 3.29 clarifies that when removing ballots from the ballot box at the end of each evening for the absentee ballots, that they're not supposed to be inspecting the ballots or counting the votes. They're just counting the number of ballots there and putting them away. Adding effective dates.
The next new language is on page 5 of the amendment.
Okay. This new language on page 5 and on page 6 adds a new option for the rejected absentee ballots to be removed in local elections. In the bill, there's language establishing a standard procedure for rejected absentee ballots to be reviewed after state general elections, and this sets up an optional process for rejected absentee ballots to be reviewed after municipal and school district elections. On 5.3 and 5.31, this language says that the change to the dates of the canvassing board meeting for school board elections only apply when it's held in conjunction with the state general election, not in odd years. On 5.8 and 5.9, there are changes related to the municipal canvassing board meetings and when they're held. And after discussions with the cities and townships, they would actually like a change on 5.9, so it says within 17 days. So I don't know if it's possible to do an amendment to change 7 to 17.
Mayor Steven, do you want to do that?
That's fine, Madam Chair.
Senator Sieben moves on the A1 amendment to strike 7 and insert 17. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So page 6 of the amendment?
On page 6 of the amendment, it's the process for reviewing rejected absentee ballots in school district elections. And in the repealer section, it's all of the same sections of law. It's just making clear that it's all of the sections of 203B13, subdivisions 1, 2, 3, and 4.
Okay. Are there questions or comments for Senator Sieben or Ms. Fraser on Senate File 1331? Is there anyone who wishes to speak on Senate File 1331? Seeing none, Senator Sieben moves that Senate File 1331, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the Committee on Finance. All who may be in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Sieben. Do we have the summary of 991 now?
You do have it?
I don't know. Do we?
We do.
Yeah, we do.
Okay. Senator Sieben or
Madam Chair,
Fraser?
I'd ask Ms. Fraser to run through the bill.
Okay, and with this one, what we did was is there an amendment on this?
Yes, there is, Madam Chair. The
I'm just trying to find it here.
A3 amendment.
91.
Adopted this.
It's 970. I don't have it. Okay. We put the amendment A3 on the bill, and now we need to have the bill explained as amended. Ms. Fraser, and we'll direct people to follow along with the Secretary of State's summary, and I'm assuming that this is to the bill and not to the bill as amended. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, the summary does often indicate how the bill was amended. Not entirely, but...
Okay. Just if you'll point that out to us, then we don't have to go back and forth. If you just say that the A3 amendment addressed that issue or whatever. Ms. Fraser.
Madam Chair, Section 1 relates to violation notices that are generally sent when a voter votes in a precinct other than their own. And this almost always happens when a voter goes to the school down the street, does same-day registration, and registers to vote, and didn't realize that because they're right on the border of the precinct that they should have gone to the church on the next block over. And so they went to the wrong place, but the election judges didn't catch it. They didn't catch it. They were allowed to vote, and the law requires that they then be sent a violation notice, which leads to stress for voters and panicked calls. But I didn't mean it. And so what this attempts to do and what the amendment does is it changes the language slightly after conversations with the governor's office so that it clarifies that a voter who votes in the wrong place would be sent, because they did same-day registration and weren't told they were in the wrong place, would be sent a notice of where they're supposed to vote in the future, and would only be sent a violation notice if they've done it more than once or if it's clear that they did it intentionally.
Madam Chair. Senator Roebling.
Would that also trigger a check to make sure that they didn't vote in another place?
Ms. Fraser.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, there's always a check to see if anyone voted in more than one precinct, because we have the statewide voter registration system. When they enter voting history, it your record comes up, and if there's already history that you voted in that election, there's a warning.
Okay.
Madam Chair and members, sections 2, 8, and 20 specify that specifies that power of attorney does not apply to voting, that the statutory definition of signature does, which provides those with disabilities options for having other people sign their name at their direction or to use a signature stamp or something like that. But what we're trying to clarify is that just because I have power of attorney for somebody, it does not mean that I get two votes. That I can, under the statutory definition of signature, help somebody, but that I don't get to just vote for you because I have power of attorney for you. Section 3 gives organizations or individuals collecting voter registration applications 10 business days to turn them in instead of 10 calendar days. Section 4 says that if municipalities change street names, they must notify the county, who must update voter records and the precinct finder, and that changes to street names are prohibited within 45 days before an election for that jurisdiction. Sections 5 and 6 are clarifications that we realized were needed as we're in the process of implementing the changes made last year related to automatic address updates for those who file permanent forwarding orders with the Postal Service, so using the national change of address data. One of the things that it does is it prohibits updates within 47 days of the state primary or of a November general election. The way that the process works is that those who file permanent notice that they've moved, we would get an address update and notify the county, who then, if it's within the state, would update their address automatically and send them something that says, you've moved as a service to you, we've updated your voter registration. If there's a mistake or there's a problem here, let us know within 21 days. Otherwise, here's where you go vote. If it appears that you've moved permanently out of state, then we send you a notice that will say that it appears you're no longer eligible to vote in Minnesota. If you are, please notify us within 21 days. Otherwise, your record will be inactivated. So the reason for prohibiting updates within 47 days of the primary or November general election is that we want to give voters the full 21 days to respond, and local governments begin printing the rosters as early as 20 days before the election. So we want to be sure before you print the roster, you're on the right roster. So we're prohibiting updates within that period. The bill passed last year, in addition to allowing for this automatic process, also requires county auditors to process non-forwardable mailings that come back and have a yellow sticker on it that say that you've moved. It requires that they update your registration on that basis. This language would allow them to wait until the next electronic notice from our office to see if the address comes through. That way, they could wait and see, do I have to do the data entry, or is it going to come through electronically and be done for me? If it doesn't come through on the next notice, then they would have to process the record. But it allows them, as long as there's not an upcoming election, to wait in that case. It also, right now, we get notices of deaths in two ways. One is from the Minnesota Department of Health, and the other is we can remove someone because they've died, because we get a signed statement from somebody registered to vote in the same county. We've realized that with a statewide system, that's overly limiting, especially if we're moving voters. And sometimes if your parents die, you might have all their mail forwarded to you. So we would then update the address, and you might send the postcard back. But since you're in a different county, this would allow us to mark you as deceased in the system. Section 7 codifies what was done in the 08 election, but makes it required in that requires that parties provide the Secretary of State's office with locations for precinct caucuses and that we must post that on our website. And instead of having them provide that information to counties and cities. Section 8 relates to the power of attorney. Section 9 requires write-in candidates for federal, state, and county offices who want their votes counted to pay a filing fee. Section
Madam Chair. Senator Roebling.
On that one, when must the filing fee be paid by? Some people may not even be anticipating that they're getting any write-in votes, but I mean, if they're running a write-in campaign, I can see it, but when would the fee have to be paid? And how much are those fees typically?
Madam Chair and Senator Roebling, this would require that the fee be paid with the request to have the votes counted. And those requests are already required by the statute. And on 6.24 of the bill, the language is there. They have to be turned in no later than the seventh day before the election. So they would have to, when they turned in their request to have their votes counted, also pay the fee. And it's the same fee that you or other office seekers pay for that office.
And Madam Chair, it's Senator very Roebling. Clear that it just applies to federal, state, and county offices. So township offices are exempt from that. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, yes. Treasure. We count all of the write-in votes in township and city and hospital district and, elections. It's only county, state, and federal.
Okay, go ahead.
Section 12... Yes, Section 10 was deleted. Section 11.
Section 10 is deleted in your amendment?
Yes.
And why was that?
Madam Chair, it was there were concerns about this provision when it was heard in the House, and we decided it was just easier to drop it for now.
What were the concerns?
The provision was put in limiting the size of precincts because there are some precincts that are very large, and it seems that there should be some limit on the number of voters. But this raised concerns in the hearing in the House that if somebody had 3,501 voters as of that date, they'd have to create another precinct, and that would require additional funds. And so we decided that for the time being, we would set this aside and perhaps talk about it and think about it more for next year. Section 11 of the bill just changes shall to must. Section 12 of...
Rachel, we want to be thorough, but we do have four other bills to do.
Okay.
And we haven't heard this bill, so that's why I'm asking for it to be section by section, but if you can pick up the pace a little bit.
Yes, Madam Chair. Section 12 of the bill and many of the sections later in the bill relate to municipal boundary adjustments, and there were changes in the author's amendment related to the municipal boundary adjustments and prohibiting them from taking effect within 21 days of an election, but adding language that was requested by the Office of Administrative Hearings. They're folks that work on annexations, and adding what they considered comfort language that if they messed up and there was an annexation within that time period, it doesn't nullify the annexation or anything along those lines. We just want, because the rosters can be printed 20 days before the election, we don't want the boundaries changing within that period. Section 13 requires that polling places in cities outside the metro area have to be within 1 mile of the precinct. This used to be a requirement that was, we've inadvertently deleted several years ago. Section 14 says that equipment purchased with the Help America Vote Act funds must be made available to other local jurisdictions that they can charge for its use, but that any the amendment added that any payment must be deposited into the jurisdiction's HAVA account, and that's required by the Election Assistance Commission, which oversees the spending of HAVA funds. Section 15 relates to the election laws volume that we have to provide to local election officials and says that we print it in the odd year and provide it electronically in the even year. Section 16 allows counties and cities to put the notice of election that's required to be posted in the office, that they can satisfy that requirement by posting it on their website. The amendment actually said that they need to do both, post it and have it on their website if they have a website. Section 17, 27, 37, 40, 46, and 47 are all related to the election reporting system, which is a database that we have and on our website where the election results are shown. And it requires that results be put into the election reporting system so they'll be available on our website in state elections and makes it optional for it to be used in odd year elections. Section 18 clarifies when candidate names are similar enough that descriptive words need to be added to the ballot. And this is amended at Senator Marty's request so that it applies when first names are similar, not identical.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
What kind of identification would you be allowed to put on there?
The nickname.
Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, the current statute allows you to put up to three additional words related to your occupation, office, residence. So perhaps it would be Beth the Baker Fraser or something.
And particularly if there were two candidates, John Johnson, both the same name, and actually, or in particular, similar last names or same last names.
So an S-E-N.
Or
S-T-O-N.
I recall Representative Carlson's opponent 1 year was like an L. Carlson. Mm. And it was confusing to people, even though the person was identified as a member of the other party.
Lyndon, the incumbent, Carlson.
Right. Madam Chair, that's what I'm wondering. Could you choose a descriptive word that could give you an edge? Or how do you decide? You know what, you know, like if you put, Carlson fiscally responsible or something. I mean, how would you determine what's fair to be placed there?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Roebling, it does limit it in the current statute to the candidate's occupation, office, residence, or a combination of them. So there are some limits, and we're just actually limiting the use of this further so that it's not just that the last names are similar, but also that the first names are similar.
So like John Johnson of New Hope as opposed to John Johnson of Crystal. I mean, that would be allowed to be added.
Right.
The resonance. Right? I mean.
Yes, Madam Chair.
Anything further, Senator Roebling?
No, I'm just hoping that we don't have descriptive words that give someone
that's current law. I mean,
an edge.
That would be trying to get rid of current law.
Madam Chair?
Senator Gimsey?
Would that apply to both names then, the descriptive words, or would it just be to one or the other?
Surname.
It looks like it is.
Page 11.
It is limiting the current statute to one reason and one reason only, and that is who have identical first names. Is that?
Yes, and
so
Madam
this is
Chair,
limitation
Senator Gimsey,
on that, Senator
both Roebling. Candidates would be allowed to add descriptive words.
So, Madam Chair, they could have similar last names, but this is further restricting it to say, in addition to similar last names, they also have to have identical first names. So we're further restricting when this could be used.
Right. So, Madam Chair.
Sure.
Senator Roebling.
When does that identifying language or descriptive words have to be put in? If you put it in when you filed for office, you may not even know yet who's filing against you. So somebody might file as they want their name on the ballot and not do anything extra because 3 days later someone with a similar name files. How do we control that?
Madam Chair, Senator
but
Roebling.
If you look at lines 11, 15, and 11, 16, there's a time limit on which the candidate furnishes those identifying words to the filing officer by the last day for withdrawal of candidacy. So it's up to the candidate, having looked at those who have filed for office, to provide the filing officer with the identifying language. John Carlson of New Hope, O-N, and John Carlson, E-N, of Crystal. And either one could do it, or none or both. They don't, they're not required to do it.
Madam Chair and members, Section 19 was deleted in the author's amendment.
And why was that?
Again, there were concerns raised in the House hearing. The rationale for it didn't entirely make sense to me. But
then why would we, you know, we don't have to do what the other body suggests if we think that what the bill has is reasonable, Ms. Fraser.
Well, Madam Chair, we were just trying to limit the number of disputes. But the rationale for this section is that right now voter registration applications may not be inspected until after the information has been entered into the statewide voter registration system. Mm-hmm. And at that point, all of the public data, or almost all of the public data, is in the system. The only piece of data that's considered public that's still on the voter registration application that's not in the system is the voter signature. So it's much easier for election officials to pull data out of the system to generate a report and provide information on voters in response to data practices requests, for example, than it is to dig out the voter registration cards and find the appropriate one and redact the exact date of birth and the identification numbers. And so local election officials would like that voter registration applications be prohibited from ever being inspected, and that if somebody wants this data, they rely on the statewide voter registration system.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay. Section 20 Section 20 relates to the power of attorney again. Section 21 relates to exit pollsters. And you may remember that last year language was changed so that no one other than a voter or someone assisting a voter could be within 100 feet of the building in which voting was taking place. That was to make it uniform with campaigning so that it was clear to election judges where people could be. Prior to the election, our office in the state was sued by exit polling companies who wanted to be closer than that, and the court ordered a temporary restraining order for the purpose of the November 4th general election, and the case is currently pending, waiting to see if the legislature takes action to address their concerns. So much of the language in this section is directly from the court order, the definition of exit polling is. We received a request from Southwest State University in particular saying that they have students conduct exit polling and that they would like to be able to do that as well. So this allows both representatives of the press and academic institutions to conduct exit polling to be within that 100-foot radius. Section 22 modifies the Voters' Bill of Rights to specify that you can take time off of work without loss of pay or reduction of vacation time to vote in the morning of election day. So it's not changing the current law. It's just specifying what it is. And since all polling places do not open at 7 a.m., in some small townships they open as late as 10, we're deleting that language. Section 23 allows ballot boxes to be open throughout the day to avoid overflowing, not just between 1 p.m. and 3 p.m. Section 24 allows voters at their discretion to vote on a surface other than a voting booth, which would allow the use of clipboards. There's not clear authorization for that to happen, so this provides that clear authorization. Section 25 was deleted in the author's amendment. We deleted it in the author's amendment in the House as well.
And why?
We were just thought that there would be concerns about it, and so we just dropped the provision for now.
Well, why shouldn't the voter have to ask them to mark the ballot?
So what this provision does is it says right now it requires, if you're having someone help you, that they have to mark your ballot. And so this allows somebody helping you, because people have different abilities, it says they may help you or they may not help you, depending on what you would prefer. So if you ask, they still have to help you. But if you don't need them to help you, that they wouldn't have to. Section 26 was changed in the author's amendment so that instead of prohibiting voters from taking pictures in the polling place, it simply prohibits voters from taking pictures of their ballot. Section 27 relates to the election reporting system. Section 28 removes the requirement that the canvas report include the names of all of the write-in candidates who requested to have their votes tallied and instead includes this in a separate report. Section 29 only requires county canvassing boards to send the Secretary of State's office one certified copy of their canvassing report and allows them to send it by messenger. Section 30 says that when printing ballots, the printer is only required to furnish the bond if the official requests it. Section 31 changes primary sample ballots so that the candidates' names are in the first rotation candidate order instead of alphabetical order, which is the same order for general election ballots and may provide some cost savings. Section 32 requires that if filling a U.S. Senate vacancy in an odd year, that the primary be held in September, not October. And there were additions in the author's amendment that also changed the filing periods and other dates to allow time for the voting equipment to be programmed and for there to be a full 30-day absentee balloting period. Section 33 brings the state into compliance with a federal law called the Continuity of Congress Law, which calls for expedited special elections in the case where more than 100 seats in Congress are vacant. Okay. The amendment allows minor parties to nominate candidates directly to the ballot. Section 34 says that cities must adopt a resolution to hold a primary at least 6 months before the next general election instead of 3 months because it's too late. Sections 35 and 36 specify that candidates filing to fill the remainder of a vacant city office, they have to file affidavits of candidacy and they have to publish a notice about the vacancy. Sections 38, 39, and 45 standardize the timing so that county auditors, city clerks, and school district clerks must all make their sample ballots available for public inspection at least 2 weeks before the election. And one of the things that the author's amendment did is the bill originally deleted a requirement that the sample ballot be posted, and the author's amendment reinstated that requirement. Section 41 clarifies that school districts don't have to hold primaries if fewer than twice the number of candidates file for office. Sections 42 and 43, or Section 42 is reworked in the author's amendment, but in both cases, it's codifying the 1994 session law, which allows school districts to transition from having elections in even years to odd years and odd years to even years. The amendment deleted language that was not needed that appeared in the bill as introduced. Section 43 prohibits school districts from holding special elections within 45 days before or after the state primary or state general, and within 45 days before and 30 days after a regularly scheduled municipal election in November of an odd year. Section 44 specifies that when school districts fill multiple vacancies, all the candidates for the same length term must file for the same office, so that you don't have vacancy number one with a four-year term and vacancy number two with a four-year term. You have one vacancy for a four-year term, and then voters vote for up to the number of candidates that are elected. Section 48 makes changes, and this was also changed in the author's amendment, but it makes changes to facilitate the state certification of election equipment and changes the timing and circumstances under which source code must be filed with the state. It must be put in escrow. The amendment requires that the source code be put in escrow. It removes the requirement that it be examined. In 2004, the last time we certified new election equipment, it cost about $200,000 to have it examined. And so we're removing that requirement, but still allowing a major political party, if they want to have it examined, they can, but they would need to pay for that examination. Section 49 says that for nonpartisan races in the even year, the base rotation order shall be set randomly by the statewide voter registration system. This is how the order for partisan races is set for the primary. Section 50 was deleted in the author's amendment. That was in this change. This changed the timing for the filing of local campaign finance reports, and there were some concerns about changing the timing, so we dropped that. Sections 51, 52, and 54 make changes to local candidates' campaign finance report that they must include the total cash on hand. The filing officer only has to notify the candidate to file the report. If the candidate has filed an initial report, they don't have to just know that the candidate now has to file reports. And extends to local candidates what was extended to state candidates a couple years ago, allowing local candidates to make charitable contributions of up to $100 a year or an unlimited amount if they dissolve within 1 year. Section 53 prohibits write-in candidates from using labels on ballots counted by optical scanners. The concern is that that can void the warranty and break the equipment. So it institutes a civil penalty of up to $5,000 per precinct payable to the jurisdiction that owns the machines to cover equipment repair and maintenance. And the equipment, the amendment said that since this process has to go through the Office of Administrative Hearings, the candidate who distributed the stickers could also be required to pay the Office of Administrative Hearing costs, so that it's not cost prohibitive for a county, for example, to get this fine. Section 55 again says if there are multiple seats for the same length term that they must all be one seat, and voters vote for up to a certain number of candidates. Sections 56, 57, 58, and 59 prohibit the annexations, and this language was changed in the author's amendment. The repealer does two things. It repeals 201.096, which eliminates a redundant provision requiring that school district clerks be given access to the statewide voter registration system. That's covered elsewhere in the statute. And it repeals 206.805 subdivision 2, which required that the source code be put in escrow when the state contract is signed. That's moved to when the equipment is certified.
Senator Sieben, it seems to me that the sections at the end of the bill have more to do with candidates than with elections. And I think maybe more appropriately belong in the campaign finance, even though it's not 10A, it's 211A, that they belong more appropriately in there. So I wonder if you would mind, and I'll certainly put them in that bill, to strike section, to delete sections 51 and 54, so that those issues can be discussed in the context of the campaign finance board's bill.
Madam Chair, the only concern is Well, the only question I would raise is that bill also moving in the House, too, your bill?
It's supposed to, yes.
Okay. Then I'm fine with that.
Okay, Senator Seidman moves to delete. Beg pardon? Sections 50, 51, and I guess it would be 52 as well. And that might also, if we deleted those sections, Senator Seidman, it might also encourage the House to hear the Campaign Finance Board's bill. So sections 50, 51, 52.
54.
54. And I think those are the only ones. So Senator Seidman moves to delete those sections from the bill. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Are there questions or comments? It's a very long and complicated bill. But are there questions or comments for Senator Seidman or Ms. Fraser?
Madam Chair, Ms. Fraser has an amendment she'd like me to offer for the A3 amendment. The wrong language was sent to Mr. Bodern accidentally. So if she could,
Ms. Fraser,
propose what she'd like to do.
Yes, Madam Chair. One change in the A3 amendment, adding a section to the bill, is on 1.33. And this changes the right.
Let's see, where, what again? What line?
On the A3 amendment.
Yes.
Line 1.34. This is related to the right to be absent from work to
yes.
vote.
Mm-hmm.
And this is mirroring an amendment that was offered in the House. And I sent the wrong language to Mr. Bodern and apologize for that. But the way it was that we would prefer to see the language is on 1.35 after work, add exclusively, and then delete the language, all of the new language on 2.2 to 2.4.
Okay, do people understand that that language change? Senator Seidman moves that amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails, and the amendment to the A3 amendment is adopted. Is there anyone who wishes to speak either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 991 as amended?
Senator,
who
Rest.
Would dare? Senator Seidman moves that Senate File 991 as amended be recommended to pass. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. We have two bills that need to go to other committees, and they need to be reported tomorrow. So we're going to take Senator Pappas's bill, 531, and then my bill, 747, and then we'll come back to the bills that only need to go to the floor. Senator Pappas brings us Senate File 531, and this bill will need to go to the Committee on Judiciary.
Madam
we will
Chair,
not
we
take up the subcommittee report because we have a delete all amendment.
So you're going to use to skip the subcommittee report?
Since we have a delete everything
okay, the delete
amendment.
Delete all, it just engrosses the bill with
yeah.
the amendment.
So we'll just take the, it just makes it easier for people. So we'll set
A4.
Aside the subcommittee report and just take up the delete everything amendment. Senator Pappas, you want to just
you
explain
do the A4 it? Amendment. There is one.
Senator Pappas moves the A4 amendment with the following change.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There is one change from the subcommittee, and that is paragraph D on line 1.25 to 1.29. So maybe I'll just explain the bill a little bit before we take it.
Okay.
There was a case where a candidate filed for office in a district where he didn't actually live. But there had to be a court order in order to remove him from the ballot. So this allows a simple mechanism to check addresses and for the filing officer to require the removal. We in the subcommittee, an issue came up about requesting data to be private if there was issues where a candidate felt like they wanted their address to be private. Maybe there had been a stalking incident or something. But the filing officer would still have access to that information so they could determine the residency. And we had some further refinement on that private data, and that's paragraph D, that the Secretary of State's office requested that if the candidate's resident address is to be classified as private data, the candidate shall list the resident address on a separate sheet to be attached to the affidavit of candidacy. And that can be reviewed by the filing officer as provided, but otherwise it's classified as private data. So the idea is somebody is checking to make sure that the person lives in the precinct, proper precinct and in the proper district, but if for whatever reason they want that data to be private, they can keep it private. Okay. So that's the addition to the A4, and I'll move the A4 amendment.
Senator Pappas moves the A4 amendment. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails, and the amendment is adopted.
So, Madam Chair, I would, if there are no questions, I'd move that Senate File 531 as amended to be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Judiciary Committee.
You've heard Senator Pappas's motion. Questions? Senator Roebling.
Madam Chair, when anyone files for office, isn't it already required that you put your residence down? I'm confused by that.
Senator Pappas?
Yes. Let's see. Actually, no. I think you cannot put your residence down.
You just have to.
You just have to say that
you live in the
district. You live in the district, right? So now we're requiring that they actually do put their residence down, but they can keep it as private data.
Okay, thank you.
So not available to anyone else. Are there further questions? Anyone want to speak in favor or in opposition to Senate File 531? Seeing none, Senator Pappas renews her motion. All those in favor of that Senate File 531 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Judiciary, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Pappas, we're going to do my bill next. Then we'll come back to yours and Senator Lori's.
Rest, Senate File 747.
Senate File 747 is a bill that addresses the issue of non-conforming lots. As you may recall, last year we've had some fairly heated testimony about either the privileges or prohibitions of those owners of non-conforming lots, their relationship with the DNR and with local governments. The bill, as introduced, was still very controversial, and so that's why you'll see on the bill that it was introduced by request. However, since that time, the parties have had a great deal of discussion. Interested parties of special interest in this issue have had extended discussions and have come up with the proposal that is reflected in the Delete Everything Amendment. And, Mr. Chairman, I move the Delete Everything Amendment, the A1 Amendment.
This is an author's amendment.
Yes, this is the first stop.
Senator Rust moves the A1 as an author's amendment. All those in favor, aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
And members, if you'll just follow along, I'm just going to go through the summary, and if you have questions, Mr. Lacosmo is here from the DNR, and he can respond to why the language is as it is and represents a compromise among the interests. So we are dealing with non-conforming uses in shoreland areas. And at the first section clarifies that damage to non-conforming property is measured by the estimated market value that are in the records of the county assessor at the time that the damage was done. So that would be the value that's going to be assigned, the estimated market value in in the county assessor's records at the time of the damage. It also provides that if the non-conforming structure, you know, think about these houses that we heard about before, is in a shoreland district with less than 50% of the required setback from the water, if you rebuild it after it's been damaged, the setback has to be increased, if it's possible, if it's practicable, and reasonable conditions may be placed on the zoning or building permit to mitigate impacts on the adjacent property or water body. So if you're fixing up something, then a building that's been damaged, you're subject to some a new standard. If you're replacing a damaged building, if it was less than 50% of required setback, then you have to, when replace it, you have to conform to some new standards that are in that section. Section 2 provides that the subdivision that there applies to shoreland lots of record on the date of adoption of local shoreland controls for lots that do not meet lot size or width requirements. And the county needs to regulate the use of non-conforming lots. And I would point out that in Section 3, the same sort of oversight and supervision is also given to cities and towns as is provided for counties in these two sections. And Mr. Lacismo is going to correct me if I interpret that summary wrongly. Paragraph B in Section 2 permits a building on a single nonconforming lot without a variance from lot size requirements if certain conditions are met and the conditions are intended to protect the water. In the paragraph C, an individual conforming lot is permitted if it's part of a group of two or more contiguous touching conforming lots under common ownership, and we heard about this last year a lot, to be treated as a separate parcel for the purpose of sale or development, again, if certain conditions are met, and the purpose is to protect the being near the water. So how you can, the conditions under which you may sell a non-conforming lot if it's part of a group or two or three lots that you own that are touching one another. Paragraph D requires a lot that's subject to that provision I just mentioned that does not meet the conditions to be combined with one or more lots that do touch one another so that they equal a conforming lot, so that you can start combining them in order to meet the conditions in order to either have them developed or have them or sold. Paragraph E allows those touching non-conforming lots under common ownership to be sold or purchased individually if each of them had a house on them at the time that the lots came under common ownership, and if the lots had adequate sewage treatment or are connected to a public sewer. And that was an issue that was brought to us last year when we had this hearing as well. F requires a property owner to address conservation and water protection measures as a part of the request for a variance or zoning or a permit that's under the rest of these paragraphs to be able to have some action on their property. Paragraph G clarifies that a portion of a conforming lot may be separated from an existing parcel as long as the remainder is conforming and the newly created parcel is combined with an adjacent parcel. And I would, you know, ask you to keep in mind, you know, the peas under the walnut shell of being moving one to another and then combining the ones that are left or half of the one that's left with one that would then make it a conforming a conforming use. And again, Section 3 is the same as Sections 1 and 2, but for cities and towns. So Mr. Lacismo is here to answer any questions. And I'm not sure if there's anyone else that wishes to testify. It's my understanding that in general, this is a compromise that, if not endorsed, is at least acceptable to the parties that have been involved in these discussions.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Vickerman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, I'm glad that you moved this bill forward. Been around here for a while.
Yep.
And I was all set to strike out a section, but your amendment makes it twice as good, so I don't need to do that. So
thank
I
you.
Want to thank you for that.
It's Mr. Lacismo, is it?
Mr. Lacismo, we've had our disputes, but we agree on this one, so I'm very happy that we could get this worked out.
Thank you, Senator Vickerman.
Senator Roebling.
Mr. Chair, I still have some concerns. I was really concerned before the amendment.
Let's get the testimony quick, and then we'll cover concerns.
Okay.
Is that okay with
mm-hmm.
folks?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mr. Lacismo?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Kent Lacismo, the Director of the Division of Waters for DNR. And I think Senator Rest did a very good job of explaining what's in this bill. I'd like to just touch on a couple things. The bills that we've seen over the last several years just provided for the sale without any standards. What we developed over the interim at the direction of Senator Rest and Representative Hillstrom was something that had conditions that all of the interested parties could live with, and that includes the cities, the Association of Counties, townships. There was an issue with the realtors that we had in the original bill, and because we were concerned about disclosure, we've worked that out. The realtors have agreed to add something to their regular disclosure statement that addresses our questions, the issues that we had over disclosure. We think that this strikes a pretty good balance between property rights and environmental protection. The one area of the bill in Section 1 that is still of concern to the builders is having any nonconforming structure that's destroyed by more than 50% of its value, to have that moved back if practicable. And I would just remind the committee that from 1974 to 2004, the requirement there was that if it was destroyed by more than 50%, it would be rebuilt conforming. So what this says is, and we had that in the original bill, and the compromise that we've reached now that it should be considered to be moved back if it's at all practical. And that's a decision that would be made by local government with the landowner. The one other point that I would make is that in paragraph C, when we're talking about the individual nonconforming lots, when they own two or more, the existing standard is that these lots would have to meet 100% of the required lot sizes. That's the existing standard. What this bill does is provide a standard that's 66% of that requirement for lot size and lot width. So that provides a significant number of properties that are out there today and that we heard about over the last several years that would allow them to be developed. So that puts I feel a significant, and our concern there was that you have adequate septic systems in place on any lots like that would be developed, and this bill provides for that. So that probably puts a lot more land in development than what we do in Section 1 that would restrict or encourage a increase in setback if they're nonconforming at less than half of the setback.
Thank you, Mr. Lacismo, and thank you, Senator Rust, for bringing forward a bill that does address so many of the concerns. Senator Roebling?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Lacismo hit upon the section that I still have some concerns about, and that would be 1.24 in particular, where it says, if practicable and reasonable conditions may be placed upon it. I always have concerns of what somebody thinks is practical, so If a building is destroyed by arson, for example, which happens sometimes on these lake properties that are left unattended part of the year, the new owner may be able to build back on the same foundation if they were nonconforming, but they may not if the local entity decides that it's not practical to do that. And, you know, but what is practical? Should they cut down the woods behind the house that was there and build back there? I'm always concerned about that. And knowing that that structure has been there all those years and may or may not have caused any problems to the shoreline, why couldn't we just let them, if they're using the same footprint, why couldn't we let them rebuild there?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Roebling, I think it's not practical, it's practicable. And that is a much higher standard than just simply being practical. It really means possible. But the way we usually put that into statute is practicable. It's not just if it makes common sense. It means you really, really have to be able to do it. And so the local government could get into trouble if they just said, well, we think you can do it. And they have to really mean that you can do it, if you're really able to be able to do it, the way I read that word.
That's correct. Mr. Chairman,
that
was the discussion that was held in other committees in the House. And initially we had if possible in there, and it was felt that if practicable was a higher standard, that it included economic considerations and possibility. So it is it's not just a whim of local governments. There has to be some justification and some real impacts. And if they have a wetland behind their property or trees or roads or bluff, I mean, it would not be practicable, in my opinion. Now, I'm not making that for local government. They certainly would have to reach their own conclusion. But we don't believe that there's a significant number of properties that are going to fall into this that are destroyed by a natural disaster. But there will be some.
Senator Roebling?
Mr. Chair, I guess I would like to make a motion, and so we can discuss this a little further, which is strike on line 120 to 1.25, starting at when, a nonconforming structure on line 120 down to the bottom of 1.25. Because I often think, you know, these homes can get flooded because they are close to a lake. They can burn. There are things that happen. And I just think if that structure was there and because of some horrible circumstance it's destroyed, that I don't know why it would harm us really to just let them put it back up or repair it on the same foundation or in the same footprint that they had before. So I would like to move that amendment.
Senator Roebling moved striking the last sentence, page 1, line 20, beginning with 1 through page 1, line 25, on that amendment.
Senator Laurie, and
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Roebling, I understand the concern, but I think that the fear is unfounded. I think this is a reasonable compromise, and I would oppose the amendment.
Mr. Chair,
before
I do that,
Senator,
I just want to make sure I'm not causing any more problem, because you said that before they couldn't do it, and now we would be permitting it. But is it with this language, or is it covered elsewhere?
Mr. Lacusmo?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, no, what I said was there was language from 1974 to 2004 that would have required a nonconformity that was destroyed to become conforming. In 2004, there were amendments to Chapter 394. In 2006, there were amendments to 462 for the cities that allowed a nonconformity that was destroyed to be rebuilt but not expanded. So that is the existing law. And, we had 30 years of that other language, and then we've had 5 years of the you can replace any nonconformity as long as you do it within the requirements of the current law. And we believe that this is a reasonable compromise that would provide some environmental protection. And overall, it is a balanced bill.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Roebling.
So by adopting my motion, we would be sticking with current law, basically.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Roebling, that's correct.
Arrest.
Senator Rest. So, Mr. Chairman, I think that the language that's in the bill represents a compromise, and I think we go away from that, and we are, opening up the controversy once again.
I was wondering.
No settlement.
That might be the result if this were to be adopted. Senator Vickerman, you had?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator, I agree with you lots of times, but this has been a pain in the butt for the last 30 years. I want it to get done with, and I think this is a compromise. Maybe it's not perfect. Nothing we do around here is absolutely perfect, but this comes a long ways.
I still move my motion.
Senator Roebling renews her motion. Everyone understand the motion? Any further discussion? All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Motion does not prevail. Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if there are others who wish to testify on the bill.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify either in favor or in opposition to Senate File 747? Senator Olsen.
I just have a question. I'm assuming that when you talk about septic systems, that non-conforming lot,
look at that work. What is
that wouldn't mean a holding tank.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olsen, for the Section E on line 2.18, when you're talking about contiguous nonconforming parcels where each has a structure on them, that language there says the lots are consistent with the PCA rules, Chapter 7080, which allow holding tanks for lots that have existing dwellings. In the other places where we talk about a type 1 septic system, that does not include a holding tank.
Senator Olsen.
Are you okay with that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olsen, we aren't attempting to write the PCA septic standards in this bill. So what we're saying is that they have to be compliant with those standards. At one point in time, as we negotiated this bill, we had a type 1 septic system for that section where you had adjacent habitable structures. But the PCA regulations provide for a holding tank as long as there's a maintenance agreement and there's a pumping schedule and it's a functioning system. So we agreed that we weren't going to try to amend the PCA Rule 7080 as a part of this process.
Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could a county ordinance, can they supersede on the lakeshore? They can't supersede your ordinances, can they?
Mr. Locksmall.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Olsen, the shoreland ordinances that the state has minimum standards and local government can be more restrictive if they desire. This bill does provide some guidance to that, and there some areas of this bill are essentially a standard that wouldn't be varied as this bill is written.
So, Mr. Chairman, I would move that Senate File 747 as amended be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on the Environment.
Senator Rest, move Senate File 747 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to Environment. On that motion, all those in favor, aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Voted right.
Thank you. Senator Pappas, I'll get you started here. And Senate File 834.
Madam Chair and members, although this bill was heard in subcommittee, no action was taken, so there's no subcommittee report. We had a bill that kind of needed some work. Mr. Jomanski has worked with me and the House author to refine the bill. It provides for ward elections in new districts after redistricting in cities of the first class. And the amendments suggested by Mr. Mansky are in the A1 amendment.
Senator Pappas moves adoption of the A1 amendment. All those, this is the, this is, there was no action taken at all. It was just a hearing. So this is an author's amendment. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Pappas.
So, Madam Chair, basically the amendment does what I said it did. It talks about when city council, that city council's redistricting, say, would happen in 2010, and we would attempt to get the new wards in place so that the city council members were running in 2011. And what happened the last go-round is with some city council members that have four-year terms, they didn't really run until 25 or
so
24.
There were portions of the city that were represented and portions that were not.
Right, that's basically the idea. And
almost represented by two people or by nobody.
And Mr. Mansky informs me that he's talked to Minneapolis and Duluth. It just relates to cities of the first class, and they're okay with this.
Okay, is there anyone who wishes to testify in support or in opposition of Senate File 834 as amended? Seeing none, Senator Pappas moves that Senate File 834 as amended be recommended to pass. Period. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Lurie. Senator Lurie brings us House Senate File 848, which is, let's see, who's here? Senator Pappas moves adoption of the subcommittee report on Senate File 848. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. We have Senate File 848 before us as amended by the subcommittee report. Senator Lurie.
Thank you, Senator Rust. This is a township elections bill. Just a couple of small sections. Really, Section 1 inserts a cross-reference to an existing statute where, you know, what people probably realize the traditional method for townships for their elections is to hold their annual meeting and their election combined in March. And a couple of years ago, we gave them the ability to move the annual meeting for inclement weather. This is a cross-reference saying, well, you can move your election, too. They would do that together, and it wasn't really addressed there. So Section 1 is just a cross-reference to that. Section 2 is a process by which townships would be allowed to return to March elections. Maybe in the mid-90s, we allowed townships to switch their township elections to the November general election. And about 500 of the 1,800 townships in Minnesota have selected that option. But if some of them would like to go back to the March elections in conjunction with their annual meetings, there's several restrictions on how this would have to be done. You would have to have run in the November election for two election cycles. It would have to be passed unanimously by the town supervisors that you wanted to go back to March, and then it would have to be passed in your by the electorate at the annual meeting to make sure that is the clear wishes of the township. Sections 3 and 4, for those townships who choose to go with a November election, those November general elections are held every 2 years, and with three supervisors, this allows them a six-year term for those town supervisors, because with a two-year term, with elections every 2 years and four-year terms, there would be instances where a supermajority of the town board would be up, and that is sometimes that is an undesirable situation. And so by offering them the option to go to six-year terms, we could stagger them so that no more than one of the three supervisors would be up in any election.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair.
Okay. Senator Bickerman.
Madam Chair, I like what you're doing, but I'm a little nervous about putting the 6 years out.
Oh, Senator Bickerman, You know how long people serve on the town boards?
<That's true. laughs> Forever and a day. They never even know that they had an election.
I had to get elected to the Senate to get off of the town board, you know. That's the only route I could find other than...
Senator Laurie, I've been here a long time, and with different ones, we tried to make our Senate term 6 years and the House four, so we didn't get into all this mess, and we got nowhere. I'm just bringing that up. Just
Mr. Sulem, would you want to give us a comment of support?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, yes, this is a bill that is one of the priorities for our association this year. We thank Senator Lurie for authoring it, and he did a great job explaining the bill. I'll stand for questions.
Okay. Senator Olsen?
Madam Chair, I'm just curious.
Take a look at your watch, Senator Olsen.
They're missing a dinner. how would Section 1 affect if we go to the early voting?
He's talking to himself.
No, and you've got all this early.
I don't think the early voting applied for township elections, did it?
Well, after 2014. So, I mean, if they move their township because of a snowstorm, you know, how does that affect the early voting hours and all that kind of stuff?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Senator Olsen, that is a very good point and one of the issues that we have with the whole idea of early voting applying to March, which is why in the next 4 years we have a lot of research and discussion. My hope is eventually we'll make that a permanent exemption for March elections.
Further discussion?
Well, Madam Chair.
Senator, well
done. I carried the first bill to allow for November elections. It was one of my first bills. And it's kind of seemed sad to me to think that they want to go back to March elections. I guess, though, that the criteria that you're establishing is pretty high, that you need all of the supervisors to agree and the town electors at the town board at the annual meeting, right? Although I thought when we originally put it on that it had to be put on the ballot at the annual election or at the election.
It is a ballot. I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Mr. Sulem.
It is a ballot question when it goes to the voters.
Yes.
So it's done by the board has to approve it unanimously, and that's for a number of reasons. And then they would submit it for voter approval at the election. The election and the annual meeting are the same day, of course, but it would be a ballot question at the election portion.
But Madam Chair, it could be. It would have to be on the November ballot then, right? Because they're
correct.
They're November.
Correct. I'm sorry, Senator. That is correct. It would be submitted at the November election, saying starting with this transition schedule. It follows the exact process that they used to get to November. Okay. Just in reverse. So it'd be a transition schedule would be proposed. It'd be part of the notice of the election. Then the voters would approve it or not approve it at that November election, and it would take effect if approved at the November election based on the transition schedule.
And Madam Chair, I would add one other thing too. I wouldn't look at it only as the downside. There are a handful of townships who have worked with the November election and would prefer to go back, but also there's a number of townships that would like to try the November election and are reluctant to do so because there's no ability to go back if they don't like it. They're not sure. So, I mean, it actually may result in a larger number of townships in the end choosing the November option by giving them some ability to go back if they try it and it doesn't work out for them. So, I mean, there's a downside but also a plus side.
Okay, Senator Lurie moves that Senate file 848 as amended be recommended to pass. All those in favor of that motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion prevails. Members, we will be meeting on Wednesday. No, on Monday. This is Wednesday. Yes?
Yep.
On Monday. That will be our last meeting. Before the deadline. So we don't know. We have a schedule already. We don't know how many more bills we're going to get with a prayer from their authors to be heard on that day. We'll try to accommodate them as best we can. And I really do appreciate you guys sticking around. There being no further business before the committee, we're adjourned.